Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
Arbeiten bei Mainova, da steckt mehr dahinter. Wir suchen Ingenieure und Ingenieurinnen wie Sie, die bereit sind, mit uns Großes zu bewegen. Als führender Anbieter für Energiedienstleister aus der Wirtschaftsmetropole Frankfurt bauen wir bei Mainova die Energieinfrastruktur von morgen. Wir bieten Ihnen eine leitende Rolle mit attraktivem Gehalt, inklusive Zusatzleistungen und vielfältige Weiterbildungsmöglichkeiten. Jetzt bewerben unter mainova.de/karriere.
I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we're hearing about the life-changing possibilities of a new law to end child marriage in Sierra Leone. Khadija Tou Barry has been telling us her story.
My mom at first wasn't for it, because my mom saw how much she has suffered suffering in the home, so she didn't want that for me. But because of religion and tradition, she supported her husband. My aunt and my cousins were there for me, so they helped me. And my last sister, whom I lost to child marriage, she was married off. She was 14.
The new chancellor of the University of Nairobi, on the blistering anger we've been seeing expressed by young Kenyans in protests that began over a proposed finance bill and continue with calls for President Ruto to resign. And how did Togo manage to eliminate not one, not two, not even three, but four tropical diseases?
The recipe includes the government's willingness to implement actions, make sure the drugs are distributed on time, that there is public awareness and education about the public's own role in accessing the treatments.
It's Friday, the 28th of June. First, we go to Freetown. Imagine what it's like to be married when you are only 15 years old or even younger. That's what's happening to many girls in Sierra Leone and indeed across countries in West Africa, where 30% are married before they turn 18 and 9% are married before they reach the age of 15. Now there's a bill waiting for President Mada Bio to sign it into law, which will change all that, improving the life chances of thousands of children in Sierra Leone. Besides a lack of opportunities for girls married off too young due to culture, religion or economic circumstance, early marriage leads to early pregnancies, which endanger the lives of girls too young to carry the burden of a pregnancy. Campaigners call the bill a piece of historic legislation. We'll hear testimony from Khadija Tou Barry about how her life was affected by the practice in a moment. But before that, Umaru Fofana told me first what the new law entails.
It's a straightforward piece of legislation which, if signed into law, essentially reinforces the country's Sexual Offences Act and even the Child Rights Act, both of which make it criminal to have sex with a minor. But despite those laws, Audrey, other existing laws such as the Customary Marriage Act and the Muslim Marriage Act still allow for girls to get married, some as young as 11 years old. So this new Prohibition of Child Marriage Act repeals those provisions and makes it criminal for anyone who takes a child, but mostly a girl's hand in marriage, or even presides over it, or even attends such a wedding ceremony. So whoever contravenes the new law faces not less than 15 years in jail, or a fine of a little over $4,000, or even both. And the victim child is liable to compensation, which should be paid by the offending adults, and their rehabilitation by the state. So it's a very wide-ranging law that sort of aims to deal with child marriage in Sierra Leone.
Right. So it criminalizes everybody that is involved in the act. How widespread is the practice, though? Is it prevalent across the country, across classes, or is it specific to certain areas and certain communities?
Audrey, I mean, it is absolutely very widespread. I mean, it happens all across the country, especially, it's got to be said, though, in the provinces, where it is considered normal and where it is firmly rooted in tradition. But it also has to be said, though, that the more rural the place, and this country is a very rural area, the more widespread the practice. And that is largely because state institutions are weak in those areas, and there is a lot of protectionism. The truth is covered up by even the victim's families sometimes, particularly where the offender is an influential person. So it's cut across. Some of the abusers or those who have been doing this have been even educated people as well. Teachers have been called out in some remote areas of being a part of this. Families of those in charge of the country's tradition have also been called out on this. So it's all across the country. It's very pervasive.
What's the justification for it?
Well, I mean, some people don't even know, let alone believe, that it is wrong. For some others, it is driven by poverty, with families doing so to cut their expenditure on further raising, particularly the girl child. Sometimes even the girls themselves, they are in for it, you know, because they are from poor homes, they live under reduced circumstances, they look forward to it in the hope that it will uplift their standard of living. Although it's got to be said, Audrey, that the opposite is mostly the case. It deepens poverty. You know, but also some parents here fear that the girls will get pregnant out of wedlock, which is considered in Sierra Leone as a shame, if not even a taboo. So as a result, they marry off their girls as early as they can.
Just tell us about the jeopardy that the girls actually face. Tell us about the physical reasons why it's dangerous for girls and also why it doesn't necessarily improve their economic circumstances.
I mean, Audrey, Sierra Leone has some of the grimmest maternal deaths in the world. And that has largely been attributed to the fact that a lot of those who conceive here and go into labor are too young to carry the pregnancy. So as a result, some of these girls who've been married off have died whilst giving birth, you know, but also born into poverty. And then these girls are married off to much older men in many cases. And then they go there, they have dropped out of school, or they even never went to school because they were married off too early to be able to go anywhere beyond primary, elementary schooling. So as a result, they don't have the economic power, they don't have resources. So it entrenches poverty amongst these young people who grow up becoming even poor and who struggle to even raise their own children, both because of their physical being, but also because of their economic circumstance.
So what's been the reaction to this proposed law?
Well, strangely, Audrey, social media has not gone agog over it. Save for some child rights and gender activists, it has not engaged the public that much. I don't know if it is because there hadn't been a real public engagement on the matter, on the bill, before and during promulgation. But as one saying goes, you know, who feels it knows it. One person who can't be happier is Khadija Tubari, who is in her mid-20s and studying gender in university. She told me her story.
At age 10, my dad came to me one time and he was telling me about a tradition that they carry in their family, that if a girl is at the age of marriage, it's the siblings that gives away that child. I was like, okay. And then he said, my sister wants you to be a wife for her own son. And I was like, no, that one is my brother. He's my koto, because we call them that. And he thought it was fun since I was just 10, and he let me be. And then he came back a few months later, and then I persisted. At a point, my dad had never laid a hand on me. He started then.
He beat you?
Yeah, he did. He did. I was so scared of them now. I will go home less. I will not really want to go there because he's there. And my mom at first wasn't for it, because my mom saw how much she herself was suffering in the home. So she didn't want that for me. But because of religion and tradition, as time goes on, she supported her husband. But my aunt and my cousins were there for me, so they helped me. And my last sister, whom I lost to child marriage, she was married off though.
So how old was she then?
She was 14. And literally, since they couldn't get me married, they sold me when I was in SS2. And teachers were paying for my fees.
Because your parents had stopped, they had discontinued paying for you.
Yes. In junior school, government was paying for girls for free. So I had free education then for girls. And for senior school, my teachers came in because my parents didn't want to pay. And you just hear them, like tradition here and everything.
Was that a way of punishing you for not, you know, accepting their proposal?
Yes, it was a way of saying that you are not a child. They even went on ahead to disown me. I remember one time saying to him, good afternoon, Dad. And then he told me, who's your dad? And I was like, oh. Since then, the relationship has been really that bad. Left home for more than for about 8 years. I attempted suicide about 3 times.
So effectively, you did not allow it to happen at all? Or did they eventually succeed?
No, they didn't succeed to marry me off because I ran away. And I had met with a really kind woman from UNICEF that had my story also. She took me in, stayed with her for 4 years here. She's no more here.
What was your driving force? What made you resist at the age of 10? What did you know about child marriage then that sort of emboldened you to say no to your parents?
I could say it was because of that one mentor that we had that was just telling us in our club, school club, that don't get married when you are not of age. If you get married at a tender age or get pregnant at a tender age, you will not become the person that you want to become. And because of movies that I watched, I grew up watching movies. I learned most of my English from movies.
What's your reaction to the Prevention of Child Marriage Act that has now been promulgated in Sierra Leone? How much do you think this can help girls?
I really wish it had happened earlier. I could have at least saved my sister or other neighbors, friends and everything. This, if this one is really propagated well, if it goes to every community, if everyone understands what's there waiting for you in case you do it, I'm sure this country will be a better one.
That's Kadiatou Barry there, Umaru. A very moving story that she's telling.
She is quite a very strong character, and I sort of couldn't get it around my head as to how come she was able to stand up to her parents at the age of 10, because she comes from a tradition where you can't say no to your parents, not least your father, when he asks for you to get married to someone. You know, she must have been a really tough girl even when she was much, much younger.
So tell me this. The bill needs the president's approval. Is he keen on it? I mean, is it a sure thing now?
Audrey, somebody joked yesterday that the president's wife would divorce him if he did not sign this into law. And it's got to be said that the first lady here, Fatima Bio, has been at the forefront in campaigning against the sexual abuse of girls almost since the moment her husband became president 6 years ago. Then she launched the Hands Off Our Girls campaign. And I understand from sources at State House that she plans on inviting some first ladies from across West Africa to be here next week when it is hoped that this will be signed into law. So I think it is more of a formality now than anything else that it will be signed into law. And that's also because the president's legislative agenda on women has been praised both locally and internationally. The Land Rights Act, which sort of now gives women power to own land in the provinces, but also the law against rape, especially of minors. So clearly, I mean, I can bet my last Leon on that yes, he's going to sign it into law. It's a matter of when and not if.
I'm hoping it doesn't come to that, Umaru. but anyway, it seems to me that women and girls in Sierra Leone have something to celebrate next week.
It does seem that way, Audrey. It definitely does seem like they do have something to celebrate. And about knowledge of it has to be deepened, frankly. Kadiatou, sort of like, you know, some would say lucky, some would say tenacious, some would say hard at fortuitous fortune for teachers to come in and help her, and then for the UNICEF person to have heard of her story to step in to help her. But a lot of other girls are out there, they don't even know it is acceptable to say no to your parents. Some mothers don't want their daughters to do it, but such is the stratum, such is the society, that many women, probably most of them in rural areas, cannot say no to what their husbands have said yes to. So it requires a root and branch reform, so to speak, for this to really be implementable and for it to really have its desired effect.
Fantastic. Thank you.
All right.
Okay.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Umaru Fofana in Freetown. And if you've been affected by anything you heard in his interview with Kadiatou, advice is available online at befrienders.org. Over the last few days, we've been witnessing the fury of young Kenyans as protests for a finance bill to be repealed shifted to a demand for President Ruto to resign. The demonstrations began peacefully and ended up with dead bodies, burning streets, arrests, and a country shook up by the violent response meted out to young people who'd merely organized a protest over a tax law. Many of those we saw out on the streets were university students. So we thought it was a good time to discuss the state of things with Gen Z, the people out on the streets, with the new chancellor of the University of Nairobi. That conversation will follow this quick roundup from Charles Gitonga, who told me where things stood at the time of recording this program.
Today being Friday, the scenes have really calmed down compared to yesterday. where there were still protests in the Nairobi CBD and other parts of the city and other parts of the country as well. All the major towns and cities like Mombasa towards the coast, the Indian Ocean, and Kisumu on the western part of the country, we saw protests there as well. However, this time we've seen an even stronger response by the police compared to what we were talking about on Tuesday. So far, 23 people have been reported killed in those protests. We've had reports of many others nursing gunshot wounds in various hospitals in the city and other parts of the country as well. And the conversations are still going on social media and on ground. And the tone of the protests has changed. The most upfront message before Tuesday and on Tuesday was reject the finance bill. But the tone now and the message now is that the country has lost legitimacy or his leadership. They do not have faith in his leadership, rather, and they feel that he needs to step down. So if you go on social media, on X, for instance, the top trending topic in Kenya is hashtag Ruto must go, hashtag Ruto must resign. So that's how far the conversation has come now, Audrey.
But what has been the political fallout for the police action? Because that seemed to take many people by surprise. Has there been a fall guy for that or an explanation for why the police were so heavy-handed?
The government is yet to acknowledge at the highest level. By that, I mean President Ruto. He's yet to acknowledge and accept any responsibility for the conduct of the police. The only conversation or the only speech that was quite interesting, when the president spoke on Wednesday, the deputy president spoke after him in a different part of the country, and he blamed the National Intelligence Service for not providing proper and accurate and timely briefs to the president. And in his argument, he said that the National Intelligence Service would have been able to tell the president that the country did not want the bill, and the president would have been able to make a better decision and prevent the deaths that we've seen and the destruction of property that we have seen. So he also called for the head of the National Intelligence Service to resign. We've not seen that happening. We've not seen a formal response from the National Intelligence Service towards that.
So finger-pointing, blame-shifting, and ultimately fallout as a result of the protests that have been sweeping the streets of Kenya in the last few days. Thank you so much, Charles.
Thank you, Audrey.
Now, President Ruto appointed Professor Patrick Verkoyen Chancellor of the University of Nairobi in January. So has he been talking to the president about the unfolding crisis on the streets of Kenya?
In the last few weeks, I've been very intensely exchanging views with the president. And my role as Chancellor of the University of Nairobi is to see what can a higher education institution such as the University of Nairobi do to basically lift the country, lift the economy, particularly at the macroeconomic level. And precisely on that, together with the president, with President Ruto in this instance, we have launched a transformative agenda for the University of Nairobi, and we call it the Big Five, one of which is the strong focus on innovation. I mean, why is it that Ivy League universities, let's say in the United States, are so focused on innovation? Because there's a business to be made. And what we're doing at the University of Nairobi, close collaboration with government and other stakeholders, is establishing a so-called Silicon Savannah, an innovation park in Nairobi, where basically startups can be linked up to venture capitalists. Because, I mean, my sense is, Audrey, the way forward for a country like Kenya is to lift, to build on the extraordinary potential of the young people who are currently protesting. What do they need? They need higher education. They need green jobs. They need leadership skills. I mean, and that's precisely what we try to bring to the table as university in a very transformative way. And quite frankly, that is why one of the reasons I was appointed earlier this year as chancellor in the first place.
Right? Yeah, I noticed your green credentials. Yeah. They seem to be quite impeccable. What I'm wondering is, right now, those furious young adults are being met with a kind of response that seems to be completely mismatched. They're angry because they feel that the grown-ups have failed them.
Yeah, so these young adults, they're angry, they're upset because they experience a lack of opportunities. So yes, it is true, Nairobi is the startup capital. in sub-Saharan Africa. I think the numbers that there are very compelling. But there's so many more opportunities to really take that startup sort of venture capital approach in a country like Kenya to the next level. What do you need for that? You need roots and wings. You need to have one location where these startups come together with venture capitalists, the roots. And you need these young adults, they need to fly. We need to bring it to the next level. We need much more funding from venture capitalists to find these startups. So my sense is the current dissatisfaction of a subset of young adults, the best way to address this is to provide them with opportunities, whether it's in innovation, whether it's in green jobs, and to transform the country through the, sort of their key interest. I mean, you speak about, let's say, the discontent of young adults vis-a-vis the adults, the current leaders.
Yeah. Indeed, I mean, they said they feel betrayed, don't they?
Yeah.
They feel betrayed, in fact, very specifically by President Ruto, because he came, he ran his campaign on the strength of what he was going to do for young adults. He seemed to be in their corner.
Well, my take on this is the current situation is complicated from multiple perspectives. I think President Ruto not signing the finance bill, basically saying, well, let's have a deeper inclusive conversation on this, I think is a very good suggestion. But what is also needed in a country like Kenya, we need deep leadership skills, which is not only reserved for the elite, but also particularly for the young adults. So we are establishing for the first time in the history of Kenya, a specific leadership institute. And I think just to acknowledge when President Ruto visited President Biden a few weeks ago in the United States on the first official state visit in a long time, President Obama indicated that he wants to support leadership mobilization in a country like Kenya. Harvard University is ready to come to the table. So we can look at the current situation in a very sort of skeptical way. I think we need to be sort of reflective of the current situation, but I think it's much more constructive. Okay, where are we moving now from here today to tomorrow? What are the building blocks we need to institutionalize to really lift the country as a whole, whether it's on green jobs, leadership? We haven't even spoken about the potential of artificial intelligence. Think about it. At the moment, $15 trillion in the world economy is to be added in the global north. I mean, Kenya and Africa as a whole is completely being left out. Would it not be great that we bring artificial intelligence home to Africa, because it has huge potential? So I think there's all sorts of opportunities here, I would think, to turn the page and move forward in an inclusive principled way.
Yeah. Well, we've been speaking to lots of people, including some in Kenya, who are actually looking at artificial intelligence, but not just artificial intelligence, but artificial intelligence that includes the sum total of human experience and not just from the global north. So with that in mind, are you looking at joining, or have you, as the Chancellor, are you looking at opportunities of joining the University of Nairobi with other institutions on the continent, and then also in a broader sense? And if you can just talk to us a little bit about partnerships, because I think in your previous roles, you've been big on that.
Precisely. So the University of Nairobi, as you know, or as you may know, is the largest public university in Eastern Africa. So this Big Five agenda, which we're currently rolling out with the global communities supporting us, coming forward in a very sort of forward-leaning way, is basically what we're trying to do is, this is not only about the University of Nairobi, of course. There are over 30 higher education institutions in Kenya alone. So what we're trying to do is to demonstrate proof of concept about a transformation, what the role of higher education can be in Kenya. So we do this in a very open and inclusive way with other Kenyan academic institutions. And later this year, we're setting up a so-called Earth Council on the Big Five of higher education. So the University of Nairobi clearly sees itself as a partner of choice, but I mean, it's literally that. It's a partner. We are sort of a transmission belt. We cannot do this alone. I mean, public expenditures for higher education in sub-Saharan Africa, also in the foreseeable future, will be less than what we used to see, for obviously macroeconomic reasons. That's why other partners need to come to the table and are planning to come to the table to help us transform society. So I think it's a very exciting opportunity ahead of us, and I'm very committed to make this work.
Professor Patrick Verkoyen on recent events in Kenya. We'll pick up our conversation with him next time with questions from students at the University of Nairobi. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
Arbeiten bei Mainova, da steckt mehr dahinter. Wir suchen Ingenieure und Ingenieurinnen wie Sie, die bereit sind, mit uns Großes zu bewegen. Als führender Anbieter für Energiedienstleister aus der Wirtschaftsmetropole Frankfurt bauen wir bei Mainova die Energieinfrastruktur von morgen. Wir bieten Ihnen eine leitende Rolle mit attraktivem Gehalt, inklusive Zusatzleistungen und vielfältige Weiterbildungsmöglichkeiten. Jetzt bewerben unter mainova.de/karriere.
There's good news coming out of Chad this week via the World Health Organization. Chad has become the 51st country to eliminate a neglected tropical disease. It succeeded in eliminating sleeping sickness. It's the first tropical disease to be eliminated by Chad. But as significant as that is, it's actually given us the opportunity to take a broader look at how other countries are doing in dealing with tropical diseases that don't appear to get much attention, hence them being called neglected tropical diseases. What we found out in the WHO's latest report is the excellent news that Togo has eliminated not just one or two neglected tropical diseases, it has in fact eliminated four of them. And that is a big achievement for a small country. And that might be the size of it. We'll hear more about that shortly. But let's first talk about sleeping sickness. That's the disease Chad succeeded in eliminating. Dr. Louise Makao Barasa is a senior director of programs at the Ending Neglected Diseases Fund, which is a leading philanthropic organization that aims to end the suffering caused by neglected tropical diseases. So, what is sleeping sickness and how does it affect us?
Sleeping sickness is a big problem. It affects several African countries. The scientific name is Human African Trypanosomiasis, HAT. And of course, it's a vector-borne disease caused by a parasite that we call Trypanosoma. The way this affects people when we say flu-like symptoms is it comes and affects the central nervous system and there can be a sense of confusion. There's also disturbances in their sleep cycles, meaning, you know, one is not sleeping well again because of the effect on the central nervous system. And in some cases, people go into a coma and left untreated, they can also die from the disease. So the flu-like symptoms are very mild at the beginning, but left untreated, then it deteriorates further into this behavior change and then the confusion, coma, and eventually death.
Right. How does one catch it? You said it's vector-borne.
It's vector-borne. There is a parasite called the tsetsefly, which then carries the infections from humans or animals, which are the breeding sites. And therefore, when that fly bites somebody, then that parasite starts breeding in their system, in their body, and eventually develops fully. And then becomes, you know, the symptoms are then visible through, you know, what I just shared on the flu-like conditions and confusion. But then there is treatment for that.
We have to offer congratulations where they are due. So we say congratulations to Chad for doing this, for eliminating a neglected tropical disease. Togo, though, managed to eliminate four tropical diseases. Which ones are they?
Togo has eliminated guinea worm disease, which is a parasitic infection that was transmitted by contaminated drinking water. And then they've also eliminated lymphatic filariasis, which also causes elephantiasis, which are these swollen limbs that people might see among their populations. And sometimes the swelling also occurs in the arms and the legs and genitals and breasts, and it can be very painful. So they've also eliminated that. They've also eliminated sleeping sickness, similar to Chad, and then also trachoma, which is a blinding bacterial infection that occurs in the eyes due to, you know, lack of access to clean water and poor sanitation and hygiene. So those are the four main diseases that Togo has eliminated.
And how did Togo achieve that? It's a very small country, but these are huge objectives that it's reached. Is the answer perhaps in the size of the country?
That is an advantage. It's easier to control disease in a small country compared to a large one. And so, you know, in that context, when we compare the size of Togo to a country like Nigeria, which is also, you know, working hard to eliminate some of these diseases, we see that the size of Togo is equivalent to maybe one state in Nigeria. So size is an advantage in their case. But on top of that, the recipe of a political commitment that includes the government's willingness to implement actions, make sure the drugs that are availed, are donated, are distributed on time, that there is public awareness and education about the public's own role in accessing the treatments, and then also use them. And then again, clear, you know, plan to eliminate these diseases. A lot of these countries now have their strategic plans, the national NTD control and elimination plans. Those serve as roadmaps in the case of Togo and other countries to ensure that actions are taken in line with the disease elimination strategies so that.
Tell me about other African countries that may be close to reaching these objectives, because so much of our continent is in the tropics. So I imagine that there are lots of illnesses that people can get simply because of the environment, because of changes in the environment, and also because of human intrusion into the environment, where diseases might have been controlled in the past, but now they're running rampant because so many different changes are happening.
I think the continent is doing well and there are great efforts. We have a country like Malawi, which has also eliminated this elephantiasis, lymphatic filariasis, and trachoma in 2022. And so we have other countries like Rwanda and Burundi, and they are on track to be certified as having eliminated, you know, at least the river blindness, onchocerciasis and lymphatic filariasis, you know, by 2024. Kenya is another one on track. We also have Eritrea, DRC, and again, parts of Nigeria, which are on track to eliminate trachoma by 2030. You know, on top of all that, countries like Nigeria are really large. Countries like DRC are really large, and Ethiopia. These are the three main countries in Africa with the largest burden of these NTDs. And so they're reaching elimination progressively in some areas, are working with them to make sure that we support all the national efforts to eliminate these diseases.
So tell me this, governments appear to be struggling with eliminating these diseases for a long time. What's changed in the last few years that this is happening and seems to have brought these plans and the strategies together in order to eliminate these diseases?
When we look back, we had great efforts under what was the African Program for Elimination of Onchocerciasis, what was known as APOC, that ran from 1995 to 2015. But that APOC was only focusing on river blindness. There was evidence generated from that program that we could eliminate diseases. And therefore, around 2007, 2008, when we began looking at neglected tropical diseases, we had to have this time period to have a sort of proof of concept and bring other people on board, and other people, I mean, other donors, other stakeholders, to convince them that there were other diseases outside of onchocerciasis that needed attention. At the end fund, I think for us, I'll speak based on our experience, since 2012, we focused a lot on mobilizing resources and working with countries to eliminate neglected tropical diseases. And we selected five to begin with, that we could easily use medicines to prevent or to reach treatment. So we brought these diseases to the table and with proof of concept that we can actually eliminate. So you have this momentum that was built, you know, in the last 10 years that is showing and demonstrating, again, that we can really reach elimination. There's already proof coming from these countries, coming from all the disease assessments that we're doing in different countries to show actually the medicine that is being donated is working and populations can be free of these diseases. We also have our 2030 goals, that by 2030, we'll have eliminated this disease. So we have also that as something that is driving us.
Are we approaching the day when you, perhaps as somebody who works to eliminate neglected tropical diseases, will be working yourself out of a job?
That is our ideal, right? If we no longer need to treat you because you no longer have a disease, then it's a success. And if that success means I no longer need my job, then my job is done. And so, yes, we are. And it will be, you know, a good day to be out of a job.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you again. And bye.
Dr. Louise Makau Barasa, Director of Programs at the Ending Neglected Diseases Fund. Focus on Africa was compiled by Amy Leibovitz, Bella Hassan, Victor Silva and Rob Wilson here in London. Frenny Joey and Charles Kitonga were on it in Nairobi. Chris Kuzaris was our technical producer. Paul Bachibinga was the senior journalist in the room. Andre Lombard and Alice Muthengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. Let's talk again next time.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
Arbeiten bei Mainova, da steckt mehr dahinter. Wir suchen Ingenieure und Ingenieurinnen wie Sie, die bereit sind, mit uns Großes zu bewegen. Als führender Anbieter für Energiedienstleister aus der Wirtschaftsmetropole Frankfurt bauen wir bei Mainova die Energieinfrastruktur von morgen. Wir bieten Ihnen eine leitende Rolle mit attraktivem Gehalt, inklusive Zusatzleistungen und vielfältige Weiterbildungsmöglichkeiten. Jetzt bewerben unter mainova.de/karriere.